Chapter 2. The Modern Subject. Enlightenment and Dialectic. The title of Dialectic of Enlightenment, D.E., first published 1944, highlights themes which are germane to all of Adorno's work. Enlightenment is often characterized as the movement, starting sometime in the 17th century, which uses reason to illuminate what was previously obscured by myth, religion, and superstition. Dialectic, in the German traditions to which Adorno belongs, refers to understanding how things turn into their opposites. The concern is, then, with understanding change, rather than with what, like the laws of nature, remains the same. As Adorno puts it, in dialectical thinking, everything is always only what it is, by becoming what it isn't. The version of dialectic proposed by G.W.F. Hegel is one of the main philosophical influences on Adorno. For Hegel, the fact that ideas held as true, such as Ptolemy's earth-centered view of the universe, come to be refuted, is not a reason to espouse skepticism, but rather the way in which we learn more truths about the world. Copernicus needs Ptolemy to refute, otherwise he has nothing to improve on. Hegel terms this refutation of a specific existing claim that leads to a better one, determinate negation. In dialectics, things in opposition to each other also belong together, because they depend on each other to be manifest. You can't have the true without the false. The chapter of D.E. on the concept of enlightenment opens as follows. Enlightenment, in the most all-encompassing sense of progressing thought, has always pursued the goal of liberating people from fear and installing them as masters. But the completely enlightened earth radiates in the sign of triumphant calamity. What aims at liberation dialectically turns into its opposite. And the question is, why this happens? The historical context of the end of the Second World War obviously made such questions very urgent. At issue here is the very status of reason. Enlightenment reason makes it possible to gain technological mastery for human ends. But the effects of such mastery can be unreasonable, as the effects of technology on the war made clear. Reason can therefore in some sense be seen as contradictory. Unlike many philosophers, though, Adorno does not think that contradictions must necessarily be resolved, because contradiction, for him, is not just a logical issue, being instead inherent in our experience of the world. Consequently, the depth of a philosophy does not lie in the extent to which this philosophy can reconcile contradictions, but rather in the extent to which it is able to make contradictions manifest which are inherent in the matter itself. So what contradictions are inherent in the notion of reason? Reason and power. It might seem best in a philosophical discussion of reason to give a definition of what is meant by the term before investigating it. But this is not Adorno's strategy. The problem is that a definition of reason must presumably be rational. But the status of rationality itself is what is in question here. What would make the definition rational? There is no definitive way out of this dilemma, which touches on the very status of philosophy itself. On the assumption that there is no foundational certainty with respect to philosophical terms, one of Adorno's strategies is to see how those terms emerged and evolved historically. He is here influenced by Nietzsche's reflections on the way power relates to thinking. Reason, as a way of mastering things, means ends reason, which Adorno refers to as instrumental reason, is itself a form of power. His question is why this power leads to calamity in the form of totalitarianism, extermination camps, and technology-driven warfare. The need to master things is obviously necessary to the survival of living beings. But mastery must also be seen from the side of what is mastered. Even the term mastery, with its masculine connotations, can involve a sense of repression of the other. If what is mastered is itself also a manifestation of power, the scenario becomes one of a conflict between warring powers, as it does in Nietzsche's idea of the will to power as the essential basis of all existence. With respect to nature, it can then seem that the human drive for survival must entail the defeat of an enemy through knowledge of its powers. Descartes famously talked of knowledge making us lords and owners of nature, and Francis Bacon maintained that knowledge of causal necessity in nature is the basis of human power. Nor can nature be commanded except by being obeyed. And so those twin objects, human knowledge and human power, do really meet in one. Adorno and Horkheimer suggest that the need for knowledge-based control can lead to the drive for omnipotence on the part of the subject. And this is precisely what can turn into its opposite. The more uninhibitedly reason makes itself to the absolute opposite of nature, the more it regresses, as self-preservation run wild, to nature. By regarding nature just as a threat to be controlled, or as a consumable resource, we end up threatening the survival of the civilized life we seek to preserve. What is important here, and elsewhere in Adorno, is that the human subject is both part of nature and necessarily sets itself up against nature. He uses the psychoanalytical notion of projection, the displacing of one's own feelings, which are part of our nature that we cannot fully control, onto others, to analyze the relationship between humankind and nature. Projection occurs, for example, if you see the other person as angry when it is you that is angry, but can't acknowledge your negative feeling. In a section on the origin and persistence of antisemitism, D.E. extends this notion to include projection onto the world as a whole of the subject's states of mind. So taking the way humankind has come to treat the world as akin to the projections of the paranoid individual. In both cases, the subject is in the center, the world just the occasion of its delusion. The world becomes the impotent or omnipotent incarnation of what is projected onto it. Before the development of modern science, cultures employed mythology as a way of controlling nature in the imagination. Without some sense that mythology was in touch with nature, it would evidently not be effective for those who live in terms of it. The problem lies in knowing where imaginative projection stops and reality begins. In consequence, if there is insufficient differentiation by the subject of its own and the external share of the projected material, then, in a certain sense, all perception is projection. The boundary between what is inside and what is outside cannot be clearly established, and the drive for mastery of fear is therefore likely to generate delusion. The usual idea is that modern science dispels such delusion. But this is precisely what Adorno and Horkheimer want to investigate more carefully. Modern science produces true explanations, but it does so in contexts where the basis of mythology, the drive to master perceived threats, remains in place. These threats, of course, come to include new ones produced by science itself. And this situation is central to the notion of a dialectic of enlightenment. Kant. For Adorno, the very idea of an objective world develops historically out of what is necessary for human survival. Throughout his career, a key historical figure in focusing this issue is Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, whom he first read as a young man together with his friend, cultural theorist Siegfried Krakauer. D.E. cites Kant's 1781 Critique of Pure Reason, where the notion of schematism, the hidden art in the depths of the human soul, whose true workings we are unlikely ever to be able to divine from nature, is used to explain how a shared, objective, intelligible world can result from the mass of sensory input received by individual human subjects. Seeing both a bonsai and a giant redwood as trees involves the mind using a schema which abstracts from their very evident differences to show what is identical about them. The reduction of difference to identity by the subject is crucial to Kant's theory of knowledge, and to Adorno's repeated explorations of Kant as an expression of the nature of the modern world. Without such schematism, in short, without the intellectuality of perception, no impression would fit a concept, no category an example. There would not even be unity of thought, let alone of the system that everything is aimed at. The question is, why something so necessary to exploring and understanding the world can also become a threat. Adorno and Horkheimer's reading of Kant in D.E. is characteristically unorthodox. The true nature of schematism, which coordinates universal and particular, concept and individual instance, shows itself in contemporary science in the last analysis as the interest of industrial society. This is because industry gains mastery over nature by reducing it to what can be manipulated in repeatable ways. D.E. turns Kant's epistemological argument into an anthropological account of the genesis of cognition, the system of things, the solid universe of which science only forms the abstract expression, becomes the unconsciously realized product of animal equipment in the fight for life. This reading of Kant shows something vital about Adorno's relationship to philosophy. Kant is very often read as an epistemologist who wants to show how knowledge is possible via explanation of the ways the mind orders the information it receives from the world. He saw his philosophy as involving a Copernican turn away from seeking the pre-existing truth of a divinely made objective world. Objectivity itself depends instead on the activity of the mind, which relates things to each other in specific, rule-bound ways. He does not, though, explain how and why the subject comes to function in this way. This is why D.E. attempts, in the light of its questions about the real nature of enlightenment, to give a genetic account of subjectivity in order to understand the dialectic it involves. When writing about Kant and other philosophers, Adorno often does not primarily focus on the validity of their arguments, but looks instead at what the problems in an approach tell us about historical tensions of which they are a manifestation. Even if, for example, Kant's new account of the relationship between freedom and determinism is flawed, it can still be a vital resource in exploring why the modern world turns out the way it does. Adorno, then, wants to circumvent the tendency to see the history of philosophy as a history of error, which can lead to thinkers being written off, as Kant was for a time in the mid-20th century in the Anglophone philosophical world. Kant's philosophy is, instead, a force field, where, behind the most abstract concepts which come into conflict with each other, stand what are, in reality, extraordinarily vivid forces of experience. The experience in question consists in humankind's attempts to understand itself and the world without relying on theology. As such, the power of the Critique of Pure Reason does not at all really lie so much in the answer which Kant gives to the so-called metaphysical questions, as it does in the very heroic, very stoical refusal to give an answer to these questions at all. Adorno does not ignore what he calls the metaphysical need to make sense of human existence, but neither does he think that philosophy has answers to it that have timeless truth, valid for all future experience. Adorno's focus on Kant is based on the tension between the interest in the objectivity of truth on the one hand, and the reflection on the knowing subject as that which constitutes such truth on the other. What does this tension reveal about the modern world, beyond Kant's own attempt to resolve it? Kant essentially transfers the idea of natural necessity from the side of the object to that of the subject. And this shift explains why Adorno sees the subject-object relationship in dialectical terms. Natural laws describe how, if X happens, Y necessarily follows it. David Hume, 1711-76, had pointed out, though, that all the evidence for such causal laws comes from subjects observing X and Y being constantly conjoined. The basis of the law, therefore, depended on the subject's perceptions, there being no justification for saying that the causal relationship was present in the things themselves. This made future events contingent, as they can only be inferred from what happened to have been observed in the past, with no guarantee that the same will be observed in the future. Any appeal to an inherent, God-given order in the universe could therefore not be justified in philosophy. The only order that there can be said to be is a result of human observation and judgment. Kant accepts that Hume has shown that dogmatic, that is, theological accounts of the order of things, cannot be philosophically justified. At the same time, it is clear that modern science, especially in the form of Newton's laws of motion, gives us a better account of the movement of bodies in nature than what preceded it. He therefore proposes to establish what it is that makes Newton's laws possible. The subject's observation of nature is necessary for this, which involves the object side, because we don't control what perceptions we receive. However, he then argues that the necessity present in laws of nature must be produced by the subject linking perceptions together in rule-bound ways. Otherwise, as we discussed, there would just be chaos of sensory input. This much is standard fare in philosophical accounts of Kant. What Adorno focuses on, though, are the wider implications of the dialectical turn from ancient to modern, epitomized by Kant, which locates objectivity in the subject's thinking, rather than seeing it as inherent in the world. This reversal plays out in myriad dimensions of modern history, and Kant is seen by Adorno as crystallizing this history in philosophical form. In this interpretation, Adorno comes close to his contemporary Martin Heidegger's idea that modern philosophy begins with Descartes' grounding of philosophy in the putative certainty of the I think, I am, which means he sees the modern subject as that which seeks to dominate the object. Adorno's relationship to Heidegger, who was, of course, a member of the Nazi Party, is too complex to be dealt with here. But their political differences, quite understandably, made Adorno underplay their philosophical proximity. Adorno adds a psychoanalytical dimension to his account of the subject, as we discussed, by suggesting that the subject's fear of the other and its drive to control it lead the subject to project onto the world. The combination of a Kantian and a psychoanalytical view of the subject means, on the one hand, that justified knowledge depends on the subject's forms of thinking, but on the other, that these forms are linked to a drive to control nature that can become destructive. In consequence, and this suggests why the freedom-determinism issue is central in Kant, what appears to us as autonomous, powerful subject, keeps on revealing itself as conditioned, as dependent on what there is. The subject seeks to establish a post-theological order of nature, but in doing so, the mind which forgets its own origin in nature more than ever falls prey to its origin in nature. The human form of control over non-human nature leads to what Marx calls second nature, a human social world which can be just as threatening to the subject as the first nature it seeks to control. Kant's philosophy, therefore, shows how the subject is both the source of cognitive and technological control of nature, and yet can be blind to how it is itself part of that nature. Kant famously argues that we can only know how nature appears to us, not how it is in itself, thus establishing what Adorno calls the Kantian block between the subject and being. Adorno says that the critique of pure reason is at the same time a philosophy of identity, that is, a philosophy which attempts finally to ground being in the subject, and a philosophy of non-identity, insofar as it tries to limit this claim to identity through the block that the subject encounters in its cognition. Adorno's notion of non-identity suggests that the ways in which the world is ordered, such as by the commodity form, can always hide other ways in which it can be responded to. The modern growth of knowledge brings untold benefits, but also the following. The more the world is emptied of an objective meaning, of the kind he suggests is present in Plato and pre-modern theology and philosophy, and is completely resolved into our categories, so completely becomes our world, the more meaning is removed from the world at the same time. Meaning, here, is not primarily linguistic, but has to do with what makes sense of the world. The world created by modern rationality and modern forms of exchange, for all the benefits it brings, does not always become more hospitable to humankind. What societies actually invest in knowing is influenced to a significant extent by the drive to exercise power, as the amounts spent on military research and the production of arms suggest. Hegel. Adorno contrasts Kant's refusal to give cognition wholesale command over how we relate to the world with aspects of the philosophy of identity he sees in German idealism, and in Hegel in particular. Understanding Adorno depends to a great extent, along with understanding Kant, on grasping certain key ideas in German idealism. German idealism is a reaction from the 1790s onwards to the perception that Kant had created a gap between humankind and the true nature of the world. The gap was seen as threatening to lead to skepticism. If we do not know the world as it is in itself, how can we say we know the truth about the world? It was also, though, thought of as a form of alienation from nature, whose real essence was hidden from us and needed to be either uncovered or recovered. One route to overcoming the perceived split is seen as developing a philosophy which systematically articulates how subject and object relate, without leaving the residue of the thing in itself. Hegel argues that the thing in itself is actually a product of thinking. It is what results when we subtract everything we know of an object from the object. This leaves us with an empty abstraction, as opposed to the diverse cognitive and other experience we actually have of a real object in the world. Thought is, as such, inherently of the world, in the sense that it belongs to the world, as something which changes and develops, and the point is to explicate how this is the case. In one respect, Adorno agrees, and he echoes Hegel's argument. The supposedly pure object that is free of the addition of thought and perception is precisely the reflex of abstract subjectivity. The dialectical thinking Adorno espouses rejects a radical split between subject and object, but he differs from Hegel on how their relationship can be articulated in philosophy. Hegel both proposes an all-encompassing philosophical system and shows how contradiction is inseparable from thinking. Adorno adopts the latter idea, but questions the idea that these two sides of Hegel are fully compatible. In seeking to construct a philosophical system, modern philosophy is faced with the problem of how to establish a foundation for it. The traditional response to this is theological. The founding principle upon which everything rests is God. So the aim is to explicate the intelligibility of nature imbued in it by the Creator. In Spinoza's pantheism, which heavily influenced German idealism, God actually is nature, qua the totality of the universe. Spinoza talks of God or nature, and maintains that there is no split between mind and nature. The mind understands itself the better, the more it understands of nature. Hegel develops a version of this idea in The Phenomenology of Spirit, 1807. Rather than being the eternal, unchanging principle of which everything that exists is a manifestation, the substance of the universe is active and develops to higher stages as the becoming of itself. It does so, for Hegel, precisely because it involves contradiction. It opposes itself to itself by moving from opaque unity to being the developed multiplicity of an intelligible world. In Hegel's terms, if we think of the notion of the universe in the sense of everything there is as being, we have thought nothing, because there is no content to the notion. Saying everything is hardly very informative. The contradiction that emerges from the idea of being forces us to try and give content to the idea by specifying what things are. The system which is to explicate the nature of things is a dynamic system of negations. Things gain their identity by being opposed to other things. Red is not blue, etc. And the very notion of colour changes as it becomes what it previously was not, when science and art reveal more about it. In Hegel's terms, the essence of something is not, therefore, its timeless, true nature, but rather its dynamic development, which he exemplifies by the development of a seed into a plant. The truth of philosophy is a progressing illumination of things by overcoming what is lacking in each particular manifestation of thought. And the final truth is the systematically articulated whole of the development. Each part of this is temporal and dependent on other parts. The whole, though, transcends time and does not depend on anything else. In sum, as Hegel says, the whole is the true. When Adorno says that the whole is the untrue, he is then directly opposed to Hegel. But they still concur in certain respects. Both think that things can only be understood by their links to the whole in which they are located, which involves development through contradiction. The question that separates them, therefore, is how one conceives of the whole. Hegel's core idea is that what he calls immediacy, where something is not related to anything else, like the notion of being, cannot be the basis of thought. And Adorno also uses versions of this idea in many contexts. Hegel also opposes the idea of a philosophy based on an initial, immediate foundation, such as Descartes' foundation of certainty in the I think I am. Instead of being fully given at the outset, the I is what develops as the subject matures, via its interactions with the world. Adorno concurs that first philosophy, like that of Descartes or Husserl, cannot be defended. There is no such last thing, nothing absolutely given and purified of all mediations, be it Husserlian pure consciousness or empiricist pure sensuous datum. Both he and Hegel refuse, then, to see consciousness and the world as separate, because each mediates the other, changing what the other actually is. Where Adorno and Hegel radically differ is in the way they interpret the relationship between universal and particular. Hegel sees universal ways of grasping the world that develop through mediation as culminating in philosophy systematically explaining the nature of mind/spirit, Geist, as, in some still disputed sense, the world making itself intelligible. The overarching whole is constituted by the subject side, which leads Hegel to use terms like world spirit to characterize the collective result of mind's historical development. Institutions and structures, such as legal systems, become effective despite the often conflicting and confused intentions of the individuals who constitute them. Hegel refers to this as the cunning of reason. Philosophy's job is to reveal the rationality in the confusions of the everyday world, so that we come to understand ourselves better and are willing to accept the necessity of restrictions imposed by forms like the law. Adorno thinks Hegel underestimates the dangers in how these societal structures determine those located within them. Far from always being rational manifestations of Geist, the structures can be the result of objective pressures that subjugate people, such as those produced by the capitalist market of commodity exchange. In this, individuals are relegated to being mere organs for the implementation of the universal, as he bluntly puts it, the impotence of spirit, Geist, in relation to reality, was demonstrated in a probably unparalleled manner by the events of the Hitler era. Consequently, the reasonableness of history can only prove itself in terms of for whom history really is reasonable. In a society riven by class and racial oppression, the philosophical command Hegel seeks as part of a story of progressing rationality becomes, for Adorno, an ideology of the status quo. Nature history. Marx and other young Hegelians had already made objections like this to Hegel, but Adorno does so in the wake of the Holocaust, which puts philosophical attempts to see rationality in history even more drastically in question. For Adorno, the law is the primal phenomenon of irrational rationality. In it, the formal principle of equivalence becomes the norm, the hiding place of the inequality of the equal, in which differences are obliterated. He is not against the principle of equality before the law, but the historical reality is that the law often leads to injustice. Legal norms cut off what is not covered by them, every experience of the specific, for the sake of seamless classification. Poet, journalist, and novelist Anatole France's comment that, in its majestic equality, the law forbids rich and poor alike to sleep under bridges, beg in the streets, and steal loaves of bread, suggests the problem, as does the fact that the establishment of the American Constitution, claiming all men are created equal, was in part the work of slave owners. Hegel maintains that the development of the universality of law is what enables us to have rights and recourse to justice at all, by reconciling conflicting interests and demands. Adorno sees such universal forms as being capable of producing the opposite of what was intended, as the bureaucratic and legal sides of Nazism showed. He cites Hegel. As the state, the fatherland constitutes a commonality of existence. As the subjective will of people subordinates itself to the law, the opposition between freedom and necessity disappears. In the light of history after Hegel, where modern states can degenerate into agents of mass oppression, Adorno regards this attempt to overcome the split between freedom and necessity as fundamentally misguided, though he tends, as his pupil Jürgen Habermas suggests, to underestimate how the law can sometimes also function as a crucial bastion against oppression. Once again, then, as he did in relation to Kant, Adorno points to how the forms of identification and classification generated by the modern subject to control nature can become objective forces which damage subjects. The dual sense of subject here is central to Adorno's dialectical approach. Subject can refer to the single individual, as well as to universal determinations. In the language of Kant's prolegomena, to consciousness in general, the equivocation cannot simply be removed by terminological clarification. For both meanings, reciprocally, require each other. The one is hardly to be understood without the other. The subject is in one sense that which seeks to overcome nature as the object which threatens it. But human history, the history of progressing command of nature, carries on the consciousness-less history of nature, eat and be eaten. The consequence of the command sought by the collective human subject is that individual, embodied, vulnerable subjects can be at the mercy of the collective product of their own actions. Adorno here follows Marx, citing this passage from Marx's Grundrisse, 1857-61, on the nature history of humankind. Just as much as the whole of this movement appears as a social process, and just as much as the individual moments of this movement begin with the conscious will and particular aims of individuals, just as much does the totality of the process appear as an objective context, which arises naturally. It admittedly results from the interaction of conscious individuals, but is neither located in their consciousness, nor is subsumed as a whole under them. Hegel, Marx, and Adorno, then, all see subject and object as always already affecting each other in such a way that the very terms, subjective and objective, do not have fixed meanings and have to be understood through their historical contexts. Objectivity is only recognizable by reflecting at every historical stage and every stage of cognition on that which presents itself in each case as subject and as object, and on their mediations. Subjective consciousness is therefore not something internal to the individual, because its content is substantially determined by objective social and economic influences. This leads Adorno to a further way of interpreting Kant's notion of the transcendental subject, the condition of possibility of objectivity, in terms of political economy. In the doctrine of the transcendental subject, the precedence is manifest of the abstract rational relations that have been separated from individual people and their relationships, that have their model in exchange. In answer to the question of how to think of the split between the transcendental subject and the particular, empirical, embodied subject, Adorno therefore suggests the living single person, as they are forced to act, is, as embodied homo economicus, more the transcendental subject than the living single person as which they must immediately take themselves. Whereas Hegel sees the totality of social relations as generating rational insight, Adorno sees it in terms of social and economic forms produced by the subject, which can become objective hindrances to to individual human flourishing. He therefore argues that the relationship between history as the location of human action and nature as the unchanging context of that action has to be rethought. We will discuss some consequences of this in the next chapter.